So, good evening, everybody, and very warm welcome to you. Really good to see a good turnout for this. So, we've started this series, which I've called Alternatives, or in brackets, Is There Another Way of Thinking About These Things? And I'm always fascinated by this, especially as history passes by. Certain generations didn't think to ask such questions at all, which, you know, later on, we find, well, of course, that's a question that should have been asked. So I'm always fascinated by what are the questions that could be being asked today that we haven't thought to ask at all. And the talks we're having sort of flutter around that sort of area. Is there another way of approaching or thinking about these things? So Alex, I was delighted to discover, because I read his books some years ago and only recently discovered that he lives just down the road, which is really nice. So we've met and drunk together and things now. But Alex was studied theology, Cambridge University, is now working at a publisher, IB Taurus, isn't it? I keep wanting to say Taurus, which is better known publisher in London, publishing a huge variety of non-fiction books. Alex himself has quite a wide brief, but tends to include the theology side of things amongst others. But he's been a writer for some time. His earlier books I was particularly taken by because they, and this was the phrase I sort of threw out to Alex, is this what you said? It was something like this, reclaiming theology from the theologians. I love that. It might have been reclaiming theology from the church. Something about trying to open up theology so it doesn't get stuck in our internal church, you know, soul-searching, but opens it up for all to engage with. How do we find a language that we can talk that isn't sort of hopelessly churchy or hopelessly using internal theological dialogue? And I found that very stimulating. He uses a lot of literature and film to help to explore theological ideas. And it got me going out and watching some of the films that I otherwise might not have watched to think, oh, what's going on here? And I mentioned tonight, one of them was the first Blade Runner. I'm not big on science fiction, but of course, Blade Runner, if you know, it's all about what being human is. And that hadn't occurred to me till Alex made the point. So we need to all go and watch Blade Runner 2 now. So those were the early books, which I found really fascinating. He's just written this book now called Exploring Doubt, which similarly I found very moving, interweaving various themes. But for many of us in the church, once upon a time, we weren't allowed to doubt. That was a bad thing. Hopefully it's gradually being rehabilitated as part of the rich network of faith. And so I think this is going to be really stimulating for us to think with Alex about this. So, Alex, very warm welcome from us. It's good to have you. Thanks for coming.
Well, what a splendid introduction. I'm thrilled to be here this evening, and it's great to see you all coming out just after Halloween. If I'm a bit slow on the ball tonight, it's because I was staying in a hotel in London last night, and the fire alarm went off at 2:30 in the morning, and we were all herded out into the street. So I was standing there for about an hour, and I had a bit of trouble getting back to sleep. So if my delivery is a little bit stumbles a bit tonight, cut me some slack, because there I was standing there in the middle of the road at 2:30 last night. But that doesn't in any way take away my pleasure of being here with you tonight, and I'm thrilled to be here at the invitation of Tim. And I'm thrilled that he thinks that a dyed-in-the-wool agnostic like me should have anything worthwhile to say in this lovely building. But maybe the doubts about whether or not I have anything to say are sort of the whole point. We're all, to a greater or lesser degree, doubters. And doubting Thomas is, in a sense, I suppose, the everyman of the New Testament. And the fact that your vicar bears more than a passing resemblance to the title role in Zeffirelli's Jesus of Nazareth means that there's no way that I could refuse him. So anyway, here I am, here you are, and it's great to be here. So in 2017, there are lots of things to be doubtful about. There's Brexit, Trump, North Korea, what's going to happen to the British economy after March 2019. The world just seems to get darker and darker rather than the opposite. And then there are our own personal woes and tribulations, the struggle many people have to make ends meet, injustice and poverty, the threat of redundancy, relationship breakdown, the inevitability of aging, the threat of illness, often terminal. How on earth do we make sense of such things, these terrible things, especially in a context where the old stories, especially the Christian story, seem to make, at least to a great many people, less sense and have less and less resonance? As Neil McGregor, some of you may have heard him on the radio, admitted last Friday on Radio 4's Feedback, he was motivated to make his new BBC series Living with the Gods, not because he thought the gods were necessarily worth rescuing, but because he wanted to find out what had motivated people to believe in them in the first place. What brought people together to worship these divine beings? His motivation was thus not at all theological, but primarily anthropological. So in an increasingly secular context, we might turn to outright atheism, as Richard Dawkins famously, perhaps some might say notoriously, has done. For Dawkins, belief in God is what he calls self-indulgent, thought-denying skyhookery. Strong stuff. Indeed, for Dawkins, faith itself can be positively dangerous, corrupting the minds of the young and the impressionable, and leading to an inevitable intolerance of the creeds of others. The late Christopher Hitchens goes further. Religion, especially in its Islamic manifestation, is actually sinful. So God, for these writers, most definitely is not great. He's a dangerous, mind-twisting fabrication. Now, while I'm very respectful of thinking atheists and am sympathetic to their rejection of a great deal of the traditional architecture of belief, it's true that the intolerance of some atheistic discourse and religion, especially inspired by these two, has led to too much certainty. Secular fundamentalism can be as unattractive, I think, as its religious counterpart. In the scramble to make sense of our lives, in my view, there's definitely too much self-confidence around. Public life is characterized more and more by a shrill barrage of offensive and mutually incomprehensible tweets and Instagrams. In the cacophony of wanting to prove that they're right and their opponent is the devil, sane conversation has more often than not been sacrificed for mere posturing, for fake news, if you like. So tonight, in search, however inadequately, of some kind of authenticity in our lives, an authenticity that doesn't just dismiss religion as bogus, I want not just to stand up for doubt, but also to make a positive case in its favor. Doubt, in my view, definitely needs to be rehabilitated. But why is the question of doubt so troubling to us? Christianity has often had a difficult relationship with uncertainty. Think of the words of the Gospel of Luke, which have often been used as a sort of benchmark in eliding or at least associating faith with conviction. If you had faith like a grain of mustard seed, you'd tell this sycamore tree, be uprooted and planted into the sea. The burgeoning certainty of faith can, it seems, move mountains as well as trees into the ocean. This perspective means that some of the more interesting Christian thinkers, many of whom have struggled with their faith, have often been pushed out to the periphery. When some church authorities began to equate faith with certainty, it was certainty, not irresolution, which became key to unlocking participation in the supposed life to come. But this is not the whole story, not by a long chalk. I would argue, just as many before me have done, that life is not a set of propositions to be understood, but a series of mysterious questions in light of whose ambiguities we find ourselves continually reshaped. Maybe one of the reasons it's so hard to talk with credibility about God in the 21st century is that we've lost sight of how to refer to the divine analogically, that is, with reference to metaphor and symbol. Thomas Aquinas, for instance, resorted to analogy to try to conceptualize the divine. Clement of Alexandria and Anselm similarly treat the 7 days of creation as allegory, not as history. Athanasius speaks of paradise as a figure. What was important here was the spiritual teaching, not the historical fact. And the medievals had no difficulty in thinking of truth as poetical and metaphorical, not as literal. In our time and gadget-obsessed world, we've lost something precious, I think, and profound, the capacity to hit the right note in regard to the transcendent, one that's not profoundly tone-deaf. The early medieval mind was not deficient or lacking because it had no access to a telescope. It was by no means contemptible because it saw the stars as tiny wrens in the sky, through which the light of heaven glimmeringly shone through. But in such an image, it was saying something important and true about what lies beyond the human capacity to grasp the unfathomable, in scientific terms, about the very limits of the universe. But how do we relate this idea of the value of mystery to our own lives? Maybe it's the medieval mystical capacity to think of God in terms of darkness as well as of light. For example, using apophatic language, that is language that describes not what God is, but what he isn't. The author of The Cloud of Unknowing speaks of a divinity hidden from experience. Light is darkness, knowing is unknowing, a cloud, and the pain of contemplating it is the agony of contemplating more reality than can actually be born. Man may see me and not live. This idea had special resonance for me 7 years ago when, living up on the Norfolk coast, my marriage suddenly and devastatingly broke up. That too seemed like an agony that couldn't be borne. God seemed especially absent, and at the time I couldn't see any meaning at all in the universe. Life was without joy, and the best that I could do was simply to endure it. But there's something in the soil of North Norfolk that pushes you, even in the most extreme of circumstances, to explore its own special history and the way that history intersects with our own. I would argue that it's precisely within cherished landscapes that we experience a sense of connectedness with our truest selves, with the selves that lie buried within, even at the bottom of the pit of misery. These are the selves that can best articulate mystery through creativity and imagination, through simile and metaphor and poetic device. Norfolk has always been a liminal place. Its borders and boundaries are ambiguous. Over the centuries, sea has become land, and land has been reclaimed by the sea, a process of erosion and change which continues to this day. Norfolk people know that while warm spring weather might be found just a couple of miles inland, on the coast, meanwhile, the horizon can be shrouded in blanketing and deadening layers of sea fog that have drifted in wraith-like and phantasmagorically from across invisible and silent waters. The unpredictable sea frets of the North Norfolk coast, which sometimes vanish as quickly as they've materialized, are a perfect symbol for the way the changing shoreline has itself enigmatically shape-shifted over the centuries. A seascape battered by erosion and the permanent threat of land loss then becomes a powerful metaphor for the wider forfeit of the things and the people we love, yet are often forced by life's vicissitudes to relinquish. The seemingly solid ground beneath our feet might crumble away at any moment. But often there is hope, even in the darkest and most unstable of places. Scattered along the North Norfolk coast are a string of churches that serve as sanctuaries to an often beleaguered seaside community. St. Nicholas at Salthouse, for example, standing on its promontory above the shoreline, is visible for miles around. Like a lighthouse, it's a beacon not just of hope, but of endurance. It has survived both time and tide. This prompts us to a realization that these venerable churches, marooned by centuries in volatile landscapes that actively seek their destruction, speak of something significant. Would the certainty of their survival, something increasingly unlikely as the sea defenses of Salthouse are finally abandoned, in fact detract from the nobility and dignity of their own mortality? Communities like Dunwich and Haysborough may fail as they're swallowed by the hungry ocean, but in doing so, are they not mirroring our own journey through the volatile landscape of instability and doubt? Death, divorce, terminations of whatever kind, sometimes desperately sad, often unexpectedly sudden. Help us to realize that nothing is certain, neither faith nor life. And yet in the midst of endings, there are new beginnings, the hidden flower in the rock crevice, the marram grass on the lonely dune. The end is not always absolute, but may contain within it the seed of transformation, however difficult that may be to appreciate at the time. So in this context of profound indeterminacy, it's no accident that some of the greatest mystical thinkers that England ever produced came out of Norfolk. And the three thinkers in question, Richeldis of Faversham, Julian of Norwich, and Marjorie Kemp, all struggled profoundly with doubt. The very word mystic is derived from the Greek word mystikos, which means hidden or obscure. Mystics understood very well that God could seem very far away, hidden, in fact, as if in a cloud. Richeldis, who was the founder of the Walsingham Shrine, doubted that her vision to build a replica of the Nazareth Holy House in Norfolk was real. Julian of Norwich at one point felt driven towards insanity. She looked back on her life after 40 years of devotion to God, a recluse from the world between the unchanging four walls of her anchorite cell, to ask, why me, O Lord? And the most profound wish of the loquacious and fantastically irritating Marjorie Kemp was that her gift of boisterous sobbing and plenteous weeping, as she herself described it, should be removed by God. She had profound doubt at times that her words, inspired by the passion of Christ, were anything other than shameful and self-destructive. Yet despite their manifold doubts, all these women persisted on the road to the end. Over and over again, medieval mystical writing uncovers something rather surprising to people who think that faith is all about certainty. And that is that God is concealed, is often perplexingly in absentia, and is revealed as much by what we cannot say about him as much as what we can. This is hardly a recipe for blind certainty about faith or the easy relationship of human beings to the divine. God, for the devoted medieval, is not always an anchor or a rock in the storm. What becomes clear is that it was precisely doubt about access to its presence that so often gave rise to their most profound insights about the nature of divinity. Yet so much of this uncertainty has in recent times been overlooked. But if we think that belief, however doubtful, is not as absurd as some might think, if we believe, to paraphrase Sam Gamgee in The Lord of the Rings, that there's some goodness in this world and it's worth fighting for, then how can a benign principle coexist alongside all the pain that we have to endure? Why can't we have more life than we do? Why are we abandoned horribly and suddenly by those whom we love? The plain fact is that against the assurances espoused by both atheists and utterly convinced believers, we don't as human beings have very many riposte to the universe's mysteries and challenges. Now, I'd love to be able to stand here and give you all the concrete answers that you might want, but I can't. Like a shifting runnel of water on a Norfolk beach, life is an elusive and meandering conundrum. We live in houses of sand, whose very foundations, just like the changing strand line and contours of the Norfolk coast, may slide and be displaced from moment to moment. But it's such a human reaction to want to hold on to certainty. The fragility of mortality, the nature of the frighteningly unstable ground around us, it all pushes us towards a handhold that might help us to find a way through the challenging marshlands which all of us throughout our lives are going to be confronted by. It's right and proper to cherish family and friends, even if losing that which we love is actually the consequence of being alive. But while individual loss may be appalling, the loss of those closest to us, the things which we feel have made us most secure in our terrible fantasy of invulnerability, whether marriage or job or some other satisfaction, it is not always or necessarily the end. In honest doubt about where we're heading, in the fertile seedbed of agnosticism, in the hope of fresh beginnings, there may still be found reasons to endure and anticipate things changing for the better. I would argue, in fact, for an appreciation of the theological value to be found in endurance, in incertitude, and in the fact that most of the time we're stumbling around in the mist with our compass needle heading in the wrong direction. This doesn't amount to despair or a rejection of transcendent value and meaning. It's rather about recognizing ultimate value above all in hiddenness, in concealment. It's an agnostic theology which recognizes that creeds and dogmatic assertions often turn mystery and myth into a set of factual propositions which counterproductively evacuate the most moving religious stories of their very capacity to transport us. Whether the overconfident and insular creed of a theological message that can't think beyond its own narrow strictures, the madness of religious fanaticism, or the false bombast of atheistic assertion that finds meaning only in what can be found in a petri dish, these are false gospels and limited and restricted in what they can offer. In order to be truly alive to the wonders the universe can contain, we need, I think, to reclaim the meaning of that which cannot be counted or measured or defined by either scripture or science. Only in losing ourselves in the sea fret may we actually be able to find what we're looking for. The medieval mystics understood this so well. In looking for the light, they found transformative darkness. In not seeing, a kind of seeing. And in the cloud of unknowing, a capacity for inner transformation, wherein was contained all the world's wisdom. In their very doubt and skepticism that they could reach God at all, they left behind a legacy comprising some of the most searching and profound of religious literature. But this isn't a truth just found in Christianity. In my book, I look at numerous nominally secular writers who grapple with profound meanings of ultimacy and uncertainty. Now, to my mind, one of the most brilliant of these is Ursula Le Guin, where, as in the Christian mystics, dualities of light and darkness abound everywhere. Her magnificent novel, The Left Hand of Darkness, nominally science fiction, but actually so much more than that, is strongly influenced by a Taoist philosophy of opposites and patterns from ancient Chinese thought, which directly parallel the apophatic, that is the negative language, of much medieval mysticism. Superficially science fiction, this novel exemplifies at a deeper level the compassionate humanity which characterizes all the great works of this writer. Located on a planet called Gethin, also known as Winter, since it's in the grip of an endless ice age, the story focuses on inhabitants who are mostly neuter, but at times exhibit the sexual and psychological characteristics of both male and female. The plot centers on the efforts of an envoy from Earth, Zhen Li Ai, to persuade the androgynes of this frozen world to join an interstellar union called the Ecumen. The Terran envoy is assisted in his efforts by the Prime Minister of Karhide, one of the competing two great powers of the planet Winter, who is named Estraven. However, this guy Estraven is toppled from power and exiled to nearby Orgarain, the other great power of the planet. So the envoy, disillusioned after his rejection by the king of Karhide, tries his luck in the neighboring country, but is thrown into a labor camp after betrayal by the very faction who'd first supported him and his objectives. Estraven dramatically rescues the envoy, and the two of them escape from his captors and betrayers across the brutal ice fields that link the two countries at their narrowest northern tips. Once they make landfall in Karhide, following a journey of extraordinary hardship, fellowship, and intensity, the envoy contacts his orbiting ship, and its crew makes preparations to descend to Winter. As news breaks of their imminent arrival, the Karhide government is persuaded to join the Ecumen, but not before the prescribed Estraven is gunned down by border guards in a doomed attempt to cross back into the other country. The envoy, who's since developed love and admiration, huge love for his friend, is numbed despite the final success of his mission. Now, this bald summary does much less than justice to the remarkable philosophy at the center of this book, which is fundamentally, even as it explores dichotomized questions of love and loss, a celebration of uncertainty. Tormented by doubts as to whether or not the planet will ever join the interplanetary alliance, the envoy at one point consults a group of foretellers called the Handarata, whose mystical and trance-like divination of the future is entered into only reluctantly and with serious qualifications. Though he's able to reassure the envoy that his mission will succeed, the chief diviner is very clear that the foretellers themselves avoid answers wherever they can. They retreat to their fastness, mostly to learn what questions not to ask. The reason for this, as the diviner explains, is that, as he puts it, The unforetold, the unproven, that is what life is based on. He continues, ignorance is the ground of thought. Unproof is the ground of action. If it were proven that there is no God, there would be no religion. There's really only one question that can be answered, and we already know the answer. The only thing that makes life possible is permanent, intolerable uncertainty, not knowing what comes next. The only thing that makes life possible is permanent, intolerable uncertainty, not knowing what comes next. In this novel, which is, I think, perhaps the most brilliant and artistically realized of all her works, Le Guin expresses the important idea not only that the mysteries of the universe are best discussed in terms of opposites, light, darkness, female, male, fear, courage, but also that the richness of life in all its possibility is absolutely dependent not on certainty but on doubt. It's our encounter with the unknown that shapes us into the people we are. So perhaps it's only by immersing ourselves in the darkness to experience desolation, deprivation, and the loss of all hope. May we fully experience the light that blinds us when our release is eventually secured. Without knowing how black the blackness was, we'd have no conception of the nature of the light or its capacity to drive darkness away. The same is true of belief. The great mystics would have had no real capacity to enter imaginatively into the suffering and passion of Christ had they not also experienced the incapacity at times to sense his presence. So by this reckoning, doubt is not something separate from faith, but it's actually essential to it. The two are integral, indissoluble. It's thoroughly regrettable that in the course, particularly of Christian history, doubt has received so little acknowledgement or appreciation as the essential incubator of the lively and robust belief that can flourish in its care. It's in the experience of dereliction and abandonment that we come to a sense that we may not in the end have been finally abandoned. It's in the failure and retreat of love that we realize how precious a thing it is and that we may want to experience it again. It's when we cry out to the unseen and unfelt heavens in full knowledge that perhaps only absence is staring back at us and all we hear is an echo, that we begin to understand the beginnings of the possibility that absence may actually be presence. It's here that metaphor and simile, or the storytelling brilliance of Le Guin, come to our rescue. The God of Dawkins and Hitchens, the God they wish to annihilate, is much as the God of some believers, is so often religiously and philosophically impoverished, stripped of the active, restless, searching energy of the medieval, reduced to a big person sitting on a cloud. But God has been domesticated, conceived only in worldly, anthropomorphized terms. The worst consequences of such appropriation are to be seen in the lunatic delusions of the jihadis, for whom God is only properly God if he's on your side, committed to the destruction of those perceived not to believe what you do. The reality is that human language of whatever kind, English, Arabic, or some other vernacular, inevitably eviscerates the divine, which is why, in my view, the best kind of theology, whether secular or religious, has always been elusive, elliptical, analogical. It's a theology which seeks God not only in scriptural assertion, but in poetry and language and music. The capacity to doubt also implies the capacity to believe, just as the capacity to believe suggests the capacity to question. Doubt and faith in the possibility of there being transcendent meaning and value in this world do not necessarily cancel each other out. They are not mutually toxic. They're both part of a mature and appropriately interrogatory perspective on the world and of our place within it. The coastline may crumble, our lives and our loves may be swept into the voracious sea, but marum grass continues to sway evocatively on the dune. When I lost my home and my wife, I thought that they were truly lost. But North Norfolk endures, and I am married again. It is right to celebrate that which we had and acknowledge the places and spaces that we loved and have made us the people we are. To paraphrase Tennyson, we are part of all that we have met. Yet at the same time, as the poet rightly says, all experience is an archway through which gleams a bright and untraveled world, rich in both possibility and promise. we have to remember that in the midst of profound uncertainty, that however far from familiar banks we may wander, however buffeting the water in the center of the river, it's not necessarily the end of things to wade into cloying mud or stumble around for a while in the uncharted backlands. Indeed, to surrender one terrain may actually be to take possession, however fleetingly, of another. So when I go back now to Norfolk in the autumn, I take delight in the thousands of migratory birds that likewise return to roost in the marsh, salt, and reed beds. Pink-footed brent and white-footed geese can be seen here in such numbers that their total absence in the spring seems so unlikely as to be almost inconceivable. Yet within months they'll be gone, flown away to their Arctic breeding grounds, and the countryside that was their habitat will again be an abandoned landscape of loss. I recognize now that there's no single resting place either for them or for me. Like mine, their home is both here and there. They're migratory creatures who exist on the winds, on the bright and violent ether through which they soar from season to season, and that ultimately is true of all of us. Their movements are ambivalent and transient. They're not in any single place, yet they're equally comfortable in several. They are both present and absent, just as we might think of God. So tonight I've made a plea, just as I do in a greater length in the book, for the value of mystery, of the value of what is unknown to us as much as what is known. I've tried to suggest that throughout religious and secular tradition, some of the most fertile minds have made sense of their lives and beliefs fundamentally through the exploration of doubt, and especially via the rich and enigmatic metaphors of absence and darkness, of ambiguity. We need to give honest dubiety its proper due, for it's surely in incertitude that we become most properly and completely ourselves, even in the face of loss and of endings. So let's finish, as I also do in the book, with the valediction by Catherine Clifton in Anthony Minghella's film adaptation of The English Patient, which some of you probably will know, which in my view is one of the most defiant instances of the articulation of hope in the face of ultimate uncertainty. In its simplicity and candor, it strips human aspiration down to the bone, to its bare fundamentals. Following a plane crash in wartime Libya, Laszlo de Almashi, the eponymous patient of the film's title, is compelled to leave behind the badly injured Catherine in a remote cave while he seeks rescue across the burning Sahara sands. Catherine is thus alone, has diminishing water and light, and diminishing water and food, and eventually no light. In those pregnant final hours before her battery is exhausted, she finds herself able to marvel at a brilliant find of Neolithic rock paintings which depict human swimmers. Their lithe and sinuous forms advance hauntingly and implausibly across the cave walls under the flickering light of her torch. 10,000 years ago, we realize, this parched and landlocked cave was close to an abundance of water. The passing of millennia, the waxing and waning of innumerable moons, has changed the face of the world. Rivers and lakes are now desert. The ancient swimmers, for all that they briefly move again, have been dead and gone for an eternity. All that remains is the memory and image of what once was. Yet for all that life seems lost, despite the fast approach of her own death, Catherine has the courage to continue writing in the darkness, to offer a last testament to the indestructibility of the human spirit, which in this instance yearns to be borne away to a palace of winds. My darling, I'm waiting for you. How long is the day in the dark, or a week? The fire is gone and I'm horribly cold. I really should drag myself outside, but then there'd be the sun. I'm afraid I waste the light on the paintings, not writing these words. We die. We die rich with lovers and tribes, tastes we have swallowed, bodies we've entered and swum up like rivers, fears we've hidden in, like this wretched cave. I want all this marked on my body, where the real countries are, not boundaries drawn on maps with the names of powerful men. I know you'll come carry me out to a palace of winds. That's what I've wanted, to walk in such a place with you, with friends on an earth without maps. The lamp has gone out, and I'm writing in the darkness. If sacred worth and meaning are to be found in migrating words which fly north, migrating birds which fly north and south, east and west, or in the hope, however unlikely and infinitesimal, of eventual reunion with those we have loved, or in the capacity to begin life anew, then I believe it's in the very doubt and ambiguity of such hopes which make them meaningful. Whether in dust or in darkness, the transcendent value of writing of the dark as well as of the light, of doubt, not proof or certainty, is surely worth celebrating, even if it means the full loss of that which we love and have loved without measure. Thank you.
Wow, that was absolutely fantastic, and really, I hope, I mean, speaking for myself, I was transported by listening to you, and very, very moved. So thank you very much for coming again, without a doubt, and I'm sure of that.